Welcome everybody. My name is Trang Duncanson. I'm the chair for this session today. And I am very honoured to chair the topic today called Market IQ Understanding the Drivers of Shareholder Return. And we have three very experienced actuaries in this field. I'm just going to give you a brief bio for each of them. Our first speaker is going to be Kevin Gomes. He has over 25 years' experience as actuary working in a wide variety of fields, life insurance, investment management. Since 96, he has specialised in general insurance, including as a consulting actuary since 2002. And Kevin currently works at Taylor Fry Consulting Actuaries, where he sits on the board of directors. Kevin believes strongly in contributing to the actuarial profession. He has served on the GIPC from the 2006 to 2010 and chairing the organising committee for several Actuaries Institute seminars. He also served for many years as a member of the Actuaries and Accountants Liaison Committee. And in his spare time, Kevin is a keen share market investor, enjoys searching for tools which might give him that elusive edge. Our second speaker is Kerry Helenius, and he's been a qualified fellow of the Actuaries Institute for over 20 years, has over 25 years' experience in the financial services industry and equity markets. He was formerly an equity partner and executive director of Goldman Sachs, J.B. Weir. He spent 10 years as senior research analyst covering insurance in gaming sectors and 5 years in the investment banking division. And Kerry is based in Melbourne. He is currently the Executive Director of Capital Advice and Market Eye and a Director of Equity Risk Management. He's had experience in equity market research, investment banking, corporate advice. He's been on the Actuaries Institute Superannuation Committee, Committee for the Future, presented at various institute conferences over the past 20 years. From 2004 to 2012, he's actually lectured on investments. So you might have heard of him, actually. And then through the University of Melbourne and then the Actuaries Institute Professional Education Program for APC 1, 2, and the recently introduced Investments course, APC 3. Our third speaker is Graham Taylor. Over 25 years of experience, again, as an actuarial analyst in general insurance. He worked for Tillinghast Towers Perrin for 12 years and is now at Taylor Fry since 1999. Graham has extensive experience in long-tail classes valuation, including CTP, medical malpractice and workers' compensation. In the last 15 years, he's used various statistical software packages to build models to explain a diverse range of data from predicting the probability of common law claims to the outcome of AFL and NRL matches. So welcome to our speakers. Today, the format, we'll get the speakers up for about 20 to 30 minutes and then I'll come back and we can start the Q&A. Thank you.
I'm sorry, we went to town a bit on those bios, so I apologise there to Trang firstly for having to read through all of that stuff. So we should have. Okay, now, the presentation today really, it might look like some pretty slides and so on, but there was actually a lot of painstaking research that went into what you're about to see today, into the drivers of shareholder return. So the research was a collaborative effort between Market Eye, which is a corporate advisory and strategic investor relations firm, and Taylor Fry, who are analytic and actuarial consulting. So as a result, we've shared this presentation between representatives of both of those firms. Unfortunately, there are intellectual property considerations which mean that our employers basically won't let us show you everything. So I apologise in advance for that. For those more observant among you, you might notice some of the charts we put up don't have numbers on them. So we feel almost embarrassed presenting to a group of actuaries without numbers, but I'm sure you'll understand. So, okay, now, it would be reasonable to expect a link between shareholder returns and financial parameters for a company on a prospective basis. So, for example, a company that has good profit growth might be expected to do well in the market and to experience superior shareholder returns. But the question we really sought to answer was, what about if we just looked at the historical financials for a company? Could that give us insight into those companies that are likely to experience superior shareholder returns going forward? And the answer to that question, somewhat surprisingly to us, was yes, and you'll see our evidence for that. But first, let me define for you what shareholder return is. So you'll see the little asterisks down the bottom of this defining it, which is really it's the share price change and the dividend yield for a company. And why is it important? Well, it's important for a number of reasons for listed companies in particular. You know, it's the main objective in setting their strategic plans. It really should be the main motivation in terms of their M&A activity, and it's typically integral in setting the remuneration rewards for executives. So you'll see a little bit more about how our research relates to those areas later on. So that's by way of an introduction to our work, and I'll now hand over to Carrie, who'll talk through the main body of our research.
Okay. When we look at total shareholder return, we sort of looked at it and thought there's a number of different factors that drive total shareholder return, and we've called them the P's and the Q's. And the Q's are really the quantitative aspects, the financials that the company can control or influence. And the P's are the other areas which are perhaps softer, harder to measure, not so easy to control. And within the P's, we've included price. So we don't think price is something that the management in a company can control, but they can influence it and they can do things that sort of have an impact on price, but we don't think they can manage the company according to price. Perception, and that's the perceptions of the management and the board and how investors are viewing the company from that perspective. And also the prospects, how's the company placed in terms of the industry outlook, in terms of its competitive position and so on. So the P's are not that easy to measure, but the Q's definitely are measurable. So we think that companies can control total relative total shareholder return by managing their financials. It sort of makes sense. You'd expect it to. You'd expect the investors will reward companies for sensible financial management, but there's not a lot of evidence or research around that actually, you know, helps support that. So what we did, and I guess looking back as an analyst, when I was a research analyst, the sorts of ratios that a research analyst would look at, and it's probably a fairly small font there, but it's things like ROE, so the return on equity, the change in ROE we've looked at. We've also looked at ROFE, which is return on funds employed, net debt to equity, the changes in net debt to equity, interest cover, payout ratio, EPS growth, revenue growth, and we've also included some price measures, dividend yield and PE. And so when we look at the measures, they basically cover things like the P&L, cash flow statements, balance sheets, and also share price for PE and dividend yield. So we would think that these factors should have some influence on total shareholder return. And so we've looked at over 225 companies, but the companies, it's 225. We haven't looked at the whole market. We've looked at companies where the P&L, the cash flow, and the balance sheets are relevant or more relevant, and that's typically the industrial companies. So we haven't included resources companies in our database, and we haven't also included the banks, not because they wouldn't work on an ROE, but because their balance sheets look a bit different to other industrials. So we've sort of aggregated the companies that we thought are the most similar in terms of their characteristics. We then looked at them over 6 monthly data points, so their interim and full year financial results, over a 10-year period. So there's over 67,500 data points that we looked at. And because we were looking at the published financials, the ratios that we were looking at were objective and clear measures. They are what they are. They were the published numbers. We haven't adjusted them for management, accounting, or other issues. And there is a strong relationship, and there's a strong relationship found for certain factors, some more than others. So the first example is ROE, and you know, again, probably not surprising that you would, you know, see a relationship with ROE. What this chart is showing us is that here you're in the positive relative total shareholder return area. Here you're getting a negative, on average, a negative total shareholder return. Over as we move along the line, we've got increasing ROE. So whilst we haven't got a number in there, I mean, it'd be safe to assume that that'd be somewhere like 15, 16%, where it crosses over. And once you start to get above that level of ROE, you then start to see, on average, positive total relative shareholder return coming out of companies. When it's below that, you tend to see, you know, negative relative total shareholder return. This is, again, in our universe of 225 companies over the 10-year period. But also, change in ROE. So you don't just have to have a high level of ROE, but a change in ROE has also got a fairly strong relationship as well. And as you have an increasing change in ROE, then you also start to get that crossover point where you start to move into that positive territory. Clearly, if your ROE is declining, you know, it tends to be negatively impacting. Okay, some of the factors. ROE was a very consistent factor. It didn't really matter when we were looking at, what time frame we were measuring it. It was getting a very consistent signal. For things like debt, and probably not surprisingly, the debt profile changes with time, and it was quite different if you looked at it pre-GFC to post-GFC. So in the pre-GFC environment, you actually saw there was this, effectively a hump. If your level of debt was too low, you're actually going into an area where you're not likely to be rewarded. If your level of debt was too high, again, you're going into an area where you're not likely to be rewarded. But there was this optimal area where if you're in that spot, you tended to get better relative total shareholder return performance. Now, that was pre-GFC. So it's important to monitor these factors because some of them will change. And this was one that changed quite significantly. So when you went into a post-GFC environment, the market became a lot more risk-averse, and debt was the big factor that they were looking at. So it really went to low levels of debt being rewarded with better relative total shareholder return performance. As soon as your debt moved into higher areas, you were tending to be penalised. So the factors do change. You do have to recognise that they change. Some of them are more resilient than others, but it's important to monitor them. And once they do change, then they do tend to hold a new sort of outline, if you like, for a period of time. It's not like they tend to jump around every few months. Okay, and whilst I say, you know, we were after the factors that a company can control, so management can control and influence, but clearly we know price is a driver. So we're not saying price isn't. But we're just saying, in our analysis, we were looking for things that companies can control and influence. But here, you can see that dividend yield, if you're in high dividend yield area, you tended to get positive outperformance. If you're in a low PE company, in this group of industrials, then you tended to get better relative performance as well. But this also got us thinking a little bit. So up till now, we've just been doing one-way analysis, looking at a factor, looking at when it outperforms, looking at when it underperforms. But you can start to see, well, here, this would suggest on dividend yield, a 5% dividend yield for a company on a nominal basis looks like it's not necessarily going to produce outperformance for a company. So we thought, is that really the best way to look at it, or is there other ways we can start to look at this data? And this is where we get to... It looks like Picasso, but it's not exactly. So what we've done here is a heat map, and now we're starting to look at factors two ways. So we have dividend yield up along the vertical axis, and now we're combining it with payout ratio up along the horizontal axis. And again, we looked at this because this is the sort of thing that boards and management often grapple with, you know, when they're setting a dividend yield. How do they actually set the dividend yield? Where are they likely to get some benefit or otherwise? But now, interestingly, if we look at the 5% dividend yield, which was suggesting no relative outperformance, and we go across the chart, the red areas are underperformance, the brighter red is strong underperformance, and as we go into the darker green, we go into stronger relative outperformance. But now along this 5% line, you can start to see that if your payout ratio is less than 50% and you're on a 5% yield, you actually start to move into the positive performance area. So to start to look at charts and to look at the data by two-way combinations, you start to get a lot more insight into it rather than just simply on a one-way basis. I mean, a lot of this would be, you know, you would expect companies that have a low payout ratio and a high dividend yield should perform strongly. So we're seeing that, you know, clearly in that top area. You would expect also that if you have a high payout ratio and a low dividend yield, you're already looking like an expensive company, so you would expect to see underperformance. But it's really this middle area which becomes quite insightful for companies. And the same thing happens with ROE. So here we're now plotting ROE versus the change in ROE. And what that enables companies to do, because some companies will basically be in an area where they say, look, we can never get to a 16% plus ROE. It's just our industry dynamics or the company structure or whatever won't allow it. But this type of map will actually say, well, perhaps you don't need to be in that area. If you can deliver certain changes in your ROE, you know, you're likely to be optimising your position and at least getting the maximum you can out of the business. So once you start to allow for the constraints of the company by looking at the analysis two ways, you tend to get more insight again and potentially helping a board or management, you know, set their strategy in terms of if they can't deliver the right ROE, can they deliver changes that actually, you know, at least they're heading in the right direction. Looking at the debt on a two-way basis, it also becomes pretty interesting. So we saw on the one-way analysis, the pre-GFC chart, there was that sweet spot. If you're too high or if you're too low, you tended to be penalised. This is a different cut of it. Now we're looking at the net debt to equity and we're looking at the change in net debt to equity. So what this tells us is, again, there was a, you know, we're seeing that sweet spot emerging. We're seeing a very strong sweet spot here. But that strong sweet spot is tying in with a reduction in debt to equity, as well as having debt to equity in the right spot. So in other words, if companies reduced their debt to equity, became more conservative with their balance sheet, but still had a reasonable level of debt to equity, they were likely to be rewarded more than if they increased their level of debt to equity to get into that sweet spot. So, you know, it's managing the balance sheet and it's managing the direction of the debt and equity that's also quite important as drivers. And, of course, that comes to the capital mix of the company. You know, how much debt should they have? How much equity should they have? You know, what's it better for the company to do, to raise equity or to try and raise some debt? But post-GFC, the environment changed completely. What it basically said was, it doesn't matter how you get there, just get there. Low levels of debt are the only things that are going to be rewarded. And as we say, this was the what we saw sort of immediately post-GFC. This is now starting to change a little bit. We're already seeing it. It hasn't reverted back to the pre-GFC, but it is starting to revert back. We're starting to see a greater tolerance for debt back in the market again. Okay, so what we could then do was start to put all this information together, put the two-way information together for companies, and then see how they looked in terms of that overall combination of financials that were covering the P&L, cash flow statement, balance sheet. And you can then produce a league ladder and do that every 6 months, every time a result comes out, and you can rank the companies from 1 to 225. And so you get an absolute figure for the ranking, but probably more importantly, you can put them into quartiles. And we did find there's actually, you know, once you start to look at the quartiles, you probably get a little bit more useful information than just looking at the absolute ranking for those companies. And should point out that when we put together those rankings, we excluded the price measures. We excluded PE and dividend yield because we were trying to find things that the company and the management and the board can influence and control. And as we say, we don't think the PE and dividend yield really fell into that category. I mean, what's the point of telling a company if their PE is too high, halve your share price and you'll have a better looking PE, you know? You've got to find things that they can do that are under their control and influence. So you'd think when you take price out of the equation, what are you going to see? We actually saw a pretty surprising outcome. When we start to look at the quartiles, that top quartile of companies outperformed on average by 9% per annum. The bottom quartile of companies on this fundamental ranking of their balance sheets, P&Ls, and cash flows underperformed by about 7% per annum. And in number, you don't get it all right. 61% by number of those companies in that top quartile outperformed for the following 12-month period. This is June to June periods, or December to December. And similarly, 60% of the companies in that bottom quartile underperformed for the following 12-month period. So with that, I'll hand across to Graham, who will actually talk about what we actually did in terms of the modelling.
I'll start by giving an overview of the model, and then I'll talk about model validation. So we applied a generalised linear model to the data and used a normal error term. The explanatory variables were the company financials measured over a year, and the response was TSR measured over the following year. Although we measured these over a year, we calculated these at each half-yearly point ending December and June, as an example shown there. Also, as we calculated relative TSR, we allowed for market movement. So if the market TSR went up 10% and a company's TSR went up 15%, that translates to a relative TSR for the market of 0 and for the company of 5%. So at each half-yearly point, the mean of our actual relative TSR is 0. We've allowed for all market movements in the period we modelled. Now I'll talk about model validation. So how do the actual relative TSR compare to the predicted relative TSR? A typical test is to group the observations into predicted quartile. So the first quartile contains the top 25% of predicted observations, predicted relative TSR. The second quartile, the second 25%, and so on. So we have four quartiles, four bands. For each of those bands, we then calculate the actual, the average of the actual relative TSR and the average of the actual, of the predicted relative TSR. And that results in the percentages shown here. So we can see that the model reflects actual experience over the period, which was financials from June 2002 to June 2010. Also, the model differentiates between the top and the bottom quartiles with a difference in relative actual relative TSR of 18%. Now, we'll have a look at how actuals compare to predicteds over time. As mentioned earlier, the mean of actual relative TSR at each half-yearly point is 0. That's shown by the red line. And the blue line shows the predicteds. So we can see that the predicteds track the actuals over the 10-year period or so, and including the holdout years. Holdout years are data not included in the model, so they're used to test the model. We effectively have two holdout years, ending June 2012 and June 2013. The last holdout year consists of the financials ending June 2012, but they predict the relative TSR at June 2013. Now, obviously, we don't know what the actual TSR is for June 2013, but we know that the relative TSR is 0, so we can use that as a holdout year as well. Now, if we look at actual relative TSR by predicted quartile, but also by time. So the solid dark green line is the average of the actual TSR for our top predicted quartile. The red line is the bottom predicted quartile. So we can see that companies in the top predicted quartile, so the dark green line, always outperform companies in the bottom quartile, the red line. And also they do it for the holdout year, so the year that wasn't included in the data. So now I'll pass over to Kevin for implications and applications.
So as you can see, we believe our model is quite robust in terms of being able to rank companies according to their predicted relative shareholder return. So really what I'll do now is just talk a little bit about what we think the implications of our work are and then perhaps how it could be applied. So in terms of the implications, well, really the link between the reported financials and the relative TSR suggests that companies can influence TSR outcomes through appropriate financial management. So really this is a framework for assessing how well management are managing their companies. So our research focused on the link between financial ratios and the relative TSR over the following 12 months, after financials were reported. This suggests to us that the impacts of the reported financials are really not just in terms of the immediate impact as those financials are reported, but can endure over the following 12 months. The fact that our model, the final model that you saw that Graham presented, excluded share price and share price related measures as an input, but it still showed that it was predicting the top quartile companies were consistently outperforming. So that would really suggest to us that a significant proportion of the relative TSR performance is indeed independent of the share price. And finally, we think that looking at things on a two-way basis really adds significantly more insight than looking at them on a one-way basis. So you saw with the material that Carrie presented that there was significantly more insight when he was looking at variables like ROE and change in ROE and dividend yield and payout ratio when he was looking at those on a two-way basis, but it added significantly more information. So how could this be applied? Here's a range of potential applications as we see it. So we think this provides really an objective framework for assessing perhaps executive remuneration. Now, you may be familiar with the three strikes policy or rules that apply, whereby when boards put up executive remuneration plans and shareholders vote them down three times in a row, that there's then a mandated board spill. So boards would be nervous in regards to putting up these executive remuneration plans. And I guess part of their nervousness may stem from the fact that it could be difficult to objectively demonstrate whether management are doing a good job or not. So we feel like our work perhaps presents somewhat of a framework for assessing whether management are doing a good job through the ranking that a company achieves relative to their peers. We feel this can be used to identify the optimal financial settings for a company. So as Carrie explained, companies look at things like where should they be setting their dividend in terms of the payout ratio. Should they be perhaps, if they need funding, should they be raising debt or equity? So we feel like our work can be used to help answer those questions in terms of looking at those financial settings and what that would mean in terms of their ranking and their predicted relative shareholder return. Companies also may want to look at strategic alternatives and, for example, M&A activity. If they're looking to acquire a company and they want to see what the impact of that company would do, then we feel this provides a framework once again for doing that in terms of feeding through how the combined company would look post the acquisition through the model to see whether that would improve their predicted relative shareholder return and ranking or not. And finally, where there may be gaps between a company's predicted relative shareholder return and their actual, and undoubtedly those gaps can happen. So as Carrie explained, the model seems to be getting about a 60% success rate of where top quartile companies are outperforming 60% of the time, which the corollary to that, of course, is 40% of companies it hasn't worked on. So why hasn't it worked? Is there a reason for that? And if it's consistently getting them wrong, perhaps there's something the company could do to identify the reason for that gap and to change it. So, for example, is a company communicating its results effectively to the market? Because perhaps the market isn't properly understanding them. So there's just a range of potential applications and and no doubt there are others. So I think that's about all the material that we wanted to go through, and we're happy to take any questions.
Can I get any questions to the microphone in the middle floor? If you could state your name and your company as well, please.
It's John Bayliss from State Super. My question is, did you also consider the volatility of those shareholder returns, and or is there further work to be done in that space?
Well, in terms of volatility, you're meaning what particular aspect of volatility?
Share price movements.
Just the volatility from year to year for a company or single, or the movement between quartiles? No, we've started to look at the quartile changes, so that, you know, how many companies remain in a particular quartile over time, and therefore, you know, does our model predict, is there a huge variation from 6 month to 6 month period in terms of the company sitting in the various quartiles? And there's a bit of change in terms of that aspect. In terms of share price volatility, because we were looking at sort of relative total shareholder returns, we sort of also did cap and collar, if you like, the performance, so that we excluded the very strong outliers and the very strong underperformers as well, because we were trying to get to the core of what companies, you know, should expect to get in terms of total relative shareholder return. So we have sort of considered volatility, but we haven't got a specific measure around volatility in our results.
Jonathan Sheed from SSGA. Thanks for really interesting research to present. Other than just noting that of the 40% where the model got it wrong, will presumably include some companies where the forecast was underperformance and they actually outperformed, so they may be less interested in changing their communication strategy. Just to comment, I suppose, that we have seen quite a dramatic growth in naive indices that actually target exactly these kind of factors. There are naive indices that target price ratios or valuation tilting. There are indices that target dividends, including filters for things like payout ratios, those kind of two-factor analysis, but also more recently indices that target quality, including return on equity, leverage, and typically stability of earnings. So my first question is, do you think those sorts of things are useful? How do they tie in with the research that you've done? And secondly, related to that, some of those indices that have been calculated back over longer periods suggest that quality-type factors like ROE and debt have been rewarded over the last 10 years, but there have been extensive periods prior to that going back to the 90s where those kind of factors weren't actually rewarded in total performance in quite the same way. I'd be interested in your response to that.
Maybe to start, I mean, I certainly think our research does support the view that, you know, the quality of the financials does have a bearing on total shareholder return. So things that are measuring that should pick up, you know, stronger performance from weaker performing companies. So I think that's the first point. The other point that we did make is that you do need to monitor these factors. So it's not that you just set and forget and set and forget. You need to watch them. Debt being a classic example where, I guess even if you went pre-GFC and you actually looked at it year by year, there was actually an increasing tolerance to debt right up to the GFC, and then it sort of flipped around on its head. So you do need to monitor the factors, and that goes back to your point that maybe not all these factors will be rewarded over a long period of time. That's why you have basically an extensive list of these factors to sort of make sure that you're keeping things that are relevant in there. Having said that, you know, I think ROE is a very, very resilient factor, and I think debt is always going to be quite an important factor. I can't see them sort of changing in a hurry, that they're not going to be drivers of total shareholder return.
Just another one that we certainly saw has changed in recent times is dividend yield. Now, dividend yield, we've explained that it doesn't feature in our model that is used to predict rankings of companies. Nonetheless, when we looked at what are the companies where our model hasn't worked quite as well, and so we were drilling down onto those, and what we've noticed is in more recent times our company hasn't companies with very high dividend yield, our model hasn't worked as well on, for the reason that right at the moment, the market is just valuing that those high dividend yield stocks disproportionately. I mean, we've seen stocks like Telstra have a tremendous run on the back of their very high dividend yield. And so, really, because dividend yield isn't one of the factors in our model, there's nothing for us to do in terms of adjusting our model. But we do note that the market has periods where it's putting certain criteria, it's changing the priority, if you like, on certain criteria.
And even there, I think, you know, it's useful for companies to identify if they've been, you know, clearly Telstra would be aware that dividend yield's been a big driver for their share price. But looking at the rest of their fundamentals and looking at where they rank is still going to be an important criteria for them, because at some point the market's going to change. Interest rates will actually start to move the other way, and then the yield stocks will actually get really penalised if all they've been valued on is yield. So it's an opportunity for those companies to start putting the other financial levers into the right spot to try and, you know, hold the gains that they've had.
So, Martin Hickling, thanks very much. Very interesting. Just two questions. Just on the data, just because obviously most coming out in February and August, but some throughout the year. How do you handle that in terms of your half-yearly data points going forward, particularly when there are various times? And the second point, you mentioned before that companies don't have any control over basically the share price, but both at the start of the period and also at the end of the period. And obviously for short measures of TSR, that's two bits of the equation which they have no control over. Have you thought about what time frame of TSR measurement, how long it has to be before the fundamental factors you're talking about that people have got under their control come much more into play rather than the starting and ending share price?
Well, I mean, I guess we haven't, you know, there's further scope to do further work here, but certainly our view is that when we've looked at a 10-year history, we tend to think that this is a reasonable framework for companies when they're setting a strategy for the next 2 to 3 years. We tend to think that's sort of the time frame that essentially, and you know, ties in with executive remuneration and those type of things, which is often over 3 years, and strategic plans of a company are often over 3 year periods. So we would be saying that, you know, that's a reasonable time frame to be looking at for you know, improvement to start to come through, and also for companies to actually take action to put themselves into better financial positions. Often it can't be done just, you know, immediately. It takes some time to sort of move towards those sort of areas. And because we're monitoring every 6 months, we're sort of keeping track of how the factors are changing as well. So, you know, the relative, if there is changes in the relative importance, or if there's change in the profile, we're sort of trying to capture that and make sure that that's being relevant. In terms of the point about data, yeah, we basically are capturing 12-month data the whole time. So when it gets to a company's interim result, we're looking at the trailing 12 months, and then at the full years, we're looking at the, you know, the full year financial position as well. So we're trying to keep all the data on a consistent rolling 12-month basis in terms of the P&Ls and the balance sheets are the balance sheets at each point in time.
Just a question on the data, but it's more how do you handle various companies reporting at different times, and how do you combine them all together given they're on different periods?
Yeah, so what we did in terms of measuring TSR, we actually took June to June or December to December year-end period. So yes, we recognise that companies are going to be at the reporting at different days, if that's what you mean, within that time frame. But we'll be capturing basically that whole month of August where the results are coming out for that group of companies typically, and there'll be, you know, a few exceptions either side, but it's the exceptions are pretty rare. So we're actually capturing June to June information in measuring and December to December in terms of measuring, and we recognise that the company's actually coming out in different days within there, but that we don't see that as being an important contributor to the analysis.
Sorry, but what do you then snap the end of August price to do the next 12-month TSR?
No. We're doing June to June, so we are actually capturing the leading, if you like, the base before the financials are released. And then we know that the financials will be released in August, and then we're measuring it through to the end of the following June. But we do have another interim result that comes in between. So, you know, there is another result that comes through, and these results are still sustaining over that period of time. And we've excluded share price.
All right. John Sheed here again. The penny's just dropped because I was listening to your presentation and thinking, yep, there's going to be a magic portfolio construction answer here about how share investors can make a mint out of this. And it got to the end, and you're talking about how we're going to talk to management and how we're going to optimize manager remuneration. So the purpose of this is managing an internal communication process for insiders, as opposed to building a model to construct share portfolios, if I've understood that right.
At the moment, that's exactly right. But we think we've got the basis for the second stage as well.
Yeah, I mean, you'd want to put share price-related measures like dividend yield and PE in if you were using it as a fund management tool, because there's no doubt the performance of the model would dramatically improve if you did that.
Which, if you recall, if Kevin had that magic formula, he would be a lot more successful with his share trading. So we have another 5 minutes if anyone would like to ask any other questions, please.
It's Martin Hicklin. I've just got one more question, just on dividend payout ratios and looking at optimal dividend payout ratios. As far as I see, it depends very much on how the company can reinvest its capital, what the optimum dividend payout ratio is. If you can reinvest your capital at a high rate of return, you basically shouldn't pay anything out. If you can't invest at a good rate of return, you should pay it all out.
Yep.
So is that something that comes through in the analysis that you've done through that two-dimensional analysis?
Yeah, look, I mean, exactly. When you look at every combination of factors, you're only looking at it two ways. So it really depends on what you're comparing against. So you could do another one which sort of compares ROE versus payout ratio. And that would probably answer your question.
Can I ask a question? Trang Duncanson, Deloitte. Have you actually advised the industrial companies on some of these measures? Have you actually seen them change their strategy or their remuneration policies and so on because of this model?
This model is just absolutely new in terms of what this has done. I have done some previous work in this area previously, and companies have taken it up. And, there is some evidence that companies that actually adopted it and actually were able to produce results have actually done pretty well. But, that was previous.
Any other questions?
John Baylor, State Super. Do you intend to publish this in some way for other people to use and, share portfolio construction?
Probably not. I mean, it's mainly because of intellectual property. Like, we've pretty much disclosed as much as we're permitted to disclose in terms of this research. Like, we are now talking to companies about them using it, and so we're pretty much not in a position where we can disclose everything. So I think publishing it we couldn't really show much more than what we've shown you today.
Yeah, the paper will be available.
Sorry, yes, this presentation will be available.
So thank you very much to our speakers today. I think it was a very interesting use of analytics in financials, and it fits in so much with the new brand actuary that we're developing right now. So can we please thank you our speakers for today.